I usually like to start my shares by describing a little bit of what's happening in my life now in terms of recovery, and especially I'm moving in less than 3 weeks to Calgary. I believe it's God's will for me, and there's a lot of things that have been happening that have been really good for my recovery and really good for my soul in the last few weeks. For example, I have a box at home that's been with me pretty much since I've been in Montreal. That's a box of things that don't belong to me. Books, DVDs, CDs, all kinds of stuff. None of this stuff belongs to me. And I've been meaning to return this stuff, and I just keep holding on to it and holding on to it. And part of me, I don't know exactly what's going on there, but part of me, I think, is I want it. I want to keep it. But part of me, too, is convinced that they don't miss it that much. And a lot of these things, I know, a few of them have asked for it back, and I know it means a lot to them. Now, a little box like that might not seem like a big thing, but I think there are two things going on there. One is, for a lot of these people, these things are important, and I'm being dismissive. And also, I'm being selfish for the things that I want to keep. So what I've done is I've gone through the box, finally just sat down, put that little bit extra effort, put down a list on a lined sheet of paper. And I've had friends say, hey, dude, we all do it. And I'm like, well, so what? This is making amends of a sort. So I made a list of the names of the stuff that belongs to. And as I'm writing down the list of the names, I'm realizing some of these people I haven't seen in a while. I'd love to know how they're doing. A couple of their names, I'm like, well, I'm not sure how I could find them. But I know, I have to be honest, who I could contact to put me in touch with them. And it's becoming more and more like doing some step work. That extra little bit of effort. I heard a great share. I've been going to lots of meetings lately, and it's been great for my recovery. I heard a share a couple of weeks ago. A fellow reminded me. He said, I like this program, and I like the way I feel when I work it. It needs work. You've got to work at it. And I can slip into times where I get lazy, and I just kind of go through the motions. And if I come at it like it's labor, you know, like I have to put my shoulder into it every day, it often, almost always, pays back. When it doesn't, it's because there's some aspect that I need to kind of check out and try a different angle often. I've come at the work a little differently. So anyway, one of these people on the list, I know that she's being moved into a home. I know her son. I can get a hold of her. It'll be a chance for me to visit her. And she was very important to me. When I first got to Montreal, I had been sober for about a year and a half, but I was also just getting off the streets. I was on the streets in my early recovery because I'd been on the streets before. And I wasn't doing the steps. I wasn't going to meetings, so I ended up homeless. And she seemed to understand that. She was one of those people who didn't, you know, I met her at church, okay? And there were people who, you know, in a church, they'd find out a little bit about me and find out where I've been and recovery and stuff like that. And they kept me at a bit of a distance. She didn't. So I'm realizing I have two of her books. That simple act of returning the book, which belongs to her, is also going to be an opportunity to reconnect and thank her. And that little bit of effort of thanking people for what they've meant to me and the things that they've done for me, I realize I've let that kind of slip too. Not kind of, a lot. There are a lot of people who've been helping me out, and I take it for granted so easily. And I wish that I had the habit more of stopping every once in a while and saying, thank you for your help. Thanks for what you did for me. Thank you for being a friend. That kind of stuff. It means something. I don't know why I don't. Maybe I do, actually. I've been reading lately, as we speak, I haven't quite finished it yet. There's a book, there it is right there, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. One of the recommended books of AA. I never got around to reading it until the last few weeks. I thought, I need something AA, steady diet in my life to kind of help me through this transition, this move. I picked up that book. I've heard great reviews of it, and they're right. It's a fantastic book. It's a chronicle of the early days of AA, and it doesn't read like a book of history. I feel like I'm being brought back to business meetings in AA before there were business meetings and the struggles that they went through to carry the message and how things bloomed and grew in the earliest days. And I've spent 10 and a half, almost 11 years in this program hearing only kind of whispers in the wind of what those early years were like. This program that changed my life, saved my life. So going back and hearing those stories, and I get a sense of where some of the traditions within the fellowship began and working with newcomers and things like that. So in there, Dr. Bob, one of the two founders, the first guy that Bill brought into the program, and the two of them kind of branched out into AA. He was a doctor, and he was seen to by some. They're very, very good at presenting different perspectives of a pretty complex man. Simple, you know, but many facets. And one of the sides is that he was seen as being pretty stern. And he admitted that one of his defects is that he could sometimes be intolerant. And he admitted that one of the reasons he was intolerant is because he feared being seen as effeminate. That spirituality, I can even point the page if you want the page. Some people struggle with the spirituality side of the program because they fear being seen as effeminate. And this is a time when men were men, right? And I think that that's true, at least for me. No control, powerlessness, acceptance, sharing, all these things. You know, where I grew up, my dad was a macho, tough cop, German-Irish cop, and a specialist in the use of force and weapons. He was a weapons expert and trained other cops on how to use these weapons, and there was a van that sat outside our house growing up filled with sawed-off shotguns and assault rifles and, you know, 9mm and all the ammunition you need, because he'd go out to the range and train other cops and help keep them fresh. And that symbol, you know, of power and authority was there all the time, and it got kind of drilled into me right away that what Dad said something, he's got backup. And one of the things he said to me is, well, my son's a bit of a pansy, and there's a whole part of him that I don't fucking like. And he made it very clear to me, consistently, that he didn't want to see any of that shit. And that shit was often me being soft, me being having an emotional side, me being forgiving. To be unforgiving was to be masculine. Forgiveness is central to this program. So, surprise, there's a bit of a thesis coming up here. I highly recommend the book. Highly recommend the book. And if you find yourself struggling with certain aspects of the program, maybe that's part of it. I don't know. I'm finding that for me it can be. So anyway, I've got this book, this box of books and CDs and DVDs. I'm in the process of returning them. Wonderful. I'm hitting lots of meetings and in the process having a chance to say goodbye. And it really is extraordinary. I've been in Montreal almost 9 years. It'll be 9 years in November. How many people I've had contact with. And in a program like AA, I start to live life a little more deeply. And I find that my connections with people can become a little more deep and meaningful. So even if they weren't necessarily long-term connections, sometimes seeing them in a home group, being a member of a home group for a couple of years, seeing them once a week, attending business meetings with them, talking about steps, working with newcomers with them, that's a pretty extraordinary connection. And there are lots of people in English and French Montreal that I had this kind of connection with. And it's been wonderful to reconnect and kind of realize, my God, I might not see some of these people again. And I used to struggle with that kind of realization because there's some sadness that comes. A combination of the spirituality and the emotional side, I guess, in my program helps me say, and I've heard it said, it's almost cliche, but I guess sometimes I'm feeling it, I hope I see you in the end. God bless. It's been wonderful knowing you. I'm not dying, I don't think, but I am moving on. Okay, so, which brings me actually to this group. Sunday Nighters, I think, is a wonderful group. I think it's a solid group within the district. I think that the introduction of the internet, sundaynighters.org, is brilliant. And I think it's a wonderful use of current technology put to the service of alcoholics. Some people might find it controversial because they don't quite understand the internet and we need to be guided by principles. Well, they're on that. They've been through that. People from all over the fellowship have been getting together and talking about, okay, we're entering an internet world. AA's, we're, and alcoholics are out in that internet world. Let's discuss how we can conduct this as members of AA. If you're curious about that, consult. There are books that come out once a year, annual reports of the meeting in New York, where representatives from across AA get together and talk about issues that are central to AA. This is one of the topics that's been coming up a lot. They've changed some of the traditions to include references, in some cases, to the internet in terms of anonymity and things like that. How does it work? If you're concerned or curious, explore it. And I think that the pioneering mindset of this group to include this kind of technology is great. And in my opinion, it's in the spirit of carrying the message. So, bravo, well done. And as a matter of fact, it was the second or third meeting that I came to when I came to Montreal. I was staying at the Welcome Hall Mission on St. Antoine, just past the Bell Center, and had gone through a bout of dryness and homelessness. I was obviously in a homeless shelter. But I hadn't been to meetings in a while, and I had been directed to Montreal by a Jesuit priest. I was homeless in Sudbury, He took me off the streets and he said, I think you should be in Montreal. And I had a feeling that came with this statement that he said that was warmth, love, and clarity, and peace. And I hadn't experienced much of that in my life, if ever. And it stood out so much that I felt myself saying, trusting, I want more of this. That feeling led me to him. I want more of it. And if I consider that to be a turning point in my recovery in my life. I made the decision to come to Montreal because of what this priest did. He took me off the streets, gave me some food and some clothes, and a place to stay for a bit. And the condition was that I meet him every night for a week, the week or two that I was there, and chat. And over the course of those conversations, it kind of came up, and I felt, okay, I should be in Montreal. So I find myself in the homeless shelter, and part of what came out of the conversation with him, connected to the same feeling, was I need to come to AA again. I'm an alcoholic. And I struggled, but I had that feeling associated, and I couldn't deny that I wanted that feeling of peace and comfort. Struggled with it. Maybe it's effeminate. Maybe I saw it as effeminate. Being embraced by something, a mantle coming over me, some kind of comfort, a wing maybe around me. Pick a metaphor. But I wanted it. Part of me did anyway. So I came here, and when I was at that homeless shelter, I realized that I had to hit a few meetings. The first meeting that I hit was the Salvation Army and the Anchorage meeting, first AA meeting that I hit when I was here in the city. And after that, I was brought to a CA meeting. I'm not a cocaine addict, actually, but I went to this meeting, and it was great. And it was fellowship, and it was steps, and cocaine addicts have stories that are slightly different than mine, but it really helped keep me on. I didn't touch cocaine that day. and then a couple of nights later, I think it was later that week, because they're very tight control. They don't let you out unless you've kind of shown them that you're committed to getting off the streets. They let me go to Sunday Nighters. And I remember it was at the old location where you walk up this hallway and they had greeters. They had a line of greeters and I was being greeted. And sadly, a number of the members that were there then aren't with the group now, but some were still here. And the meeting's still here, even though some of the faces have come and gone. But I was received, accepted, and it was wonderful. Long live Sunday Nighters. I found myself wanting to chat a little bit about how AA crept into my life. And to first mention AA's arrival, I need to go back to when I was 18. I started drinking. My first drink was at 14. And my drinking has always been tightly connected with, well, I was an Army cadet, so you could say the military. And I was an Army cadet in a Highland regiment, connected to a militia regiment that was Scottish. And I played the bagpipes. So my drinking was immersed in that culture. It was part of it, and it was part of my identity. I felt like an awkward loser before that, but I started to find my identity. I'm hardwired to be a piper, hardwired to wear a kilt, I believe. And at the time, still, because I'm an alcoholic, hardwired to drink like a piper, like a kilt wearer. So at 14, I had my first gig with the pipe band, and I got shit-faced and blacked out. And all my drinking was like that. My drinking career has always been marked like that from the start. Sought oblivion. Couldn't get drunk enough. And it happened super quickly. And I'm quite sure that I threw up because I always did. And I passed out, blacked out, still don't know how the evening finished. To this day, don't have a recall of a big chunk of that time. That was normal for me from the start. And within that organization of playing the pipes and everything, I used to teach at a bagpipe camp in the summer. And the summer that I was 18, I had a girlfriend who was from the local town, and she invited me back to her father's place. She was part of the same organization. She wasn't a musician, but she was sort of connected with the military. And she brought me back to her family's place for dinner. And I was sitting at the dinner table, and I'm a full-blown alcoholic by this time, drinking alcoholically. I'm at the risk of losing my job. I'm already drinking more than the other guys and making an arse of myself most nights. And I'm sitting at the dinner table, and they made a point of saying, you know, grace before eating, and they're very Catholic, and there's a crucifix on the wall, and these pieces of paper, 8.5 by 11, with these crazy fonts that said, live and let live. Easy does it. First things first, on the wall of, like, the dining room. And I thought, this is tacky. And I ate this dinner, it was very nice, and my girlfriend, actually, pulled me aside and said, my dad is an alcoholic, and he's been sober for a number of years now, and I think that you're an alcoholic. Maybe you could talk to him. And I was 18. I've been drinking for 4 years. And she was thinking, and it brought me to meet her father, because she thought, you're an alcoholic. And it came to a full stop. Are you out of your mind? There's no way. Part of me kind of suspected that it might be getting to be a problem, but there was just, I was so committed to it, you know, the momentum of where this drinking was leading me, the drinking career, I was so committed to it, there was no way I was going to entertain what those signs of the live and let live. I want to leave the excitement of, you know, puking and passing out and waking up in strange places for those little 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper. Forget it. So that was the first time it came, and I just brushed it aside. The second time that AA into my life was in the early mid-90s. I was homeless by this time, staying at a homeless shelter. It was like the first period that I was homeless. And I knew, okay, there's something wrong. I thought what was wrong with me was I had a mental illness, which is true in terms of AA, but I didn't see it that way. I thought that I was manic depressive because I thought that I exhibited the symptoms of it. And I wanted a pill. I wanted a pill that was going to make me better. And the only spiritual angle in my life, because I'd long since given up God, I grew up in a very religious house, pretty religious, but I was like the religious guy. I took to it more than anyone else in the family, and I was going to be a reverend. It was an Anglican church. And by the time I hit 12, a series of things led me to stop going to the church because I was all in, which is the way I do things, all or nothing. These are the things that led me to leave. Discovering alcohol, discovering erections, and nocturnal emissions, and pornography. And that's significant, because there was a pull of pornography that was enough for me to go, I don't need God. My dad had a stash of pornography on Beta that he used to get when he'd go up to the college, the police college, where he'd teach other cops how to use force. Part of that trip was he'd stay with his brother, who had a massive pornography library, and he'd grab the pornography, a few items off the shelf, bring them home and had them stashed. So I discovered that, and I thought, I don't need God, but I want this. So it all kind of happened at the same time, all these urges and everything. So I'd given up God. But in the mid-90s, when I was homeless and seeing the psychiatrist, I was able to squeeze in. I was going to a sweat lodge with the Aboriginal people in Manitoba, and I'd go once a week. And they professed, they said, if you want to follow this path, what we call the red road, this is the shaman. He was an Ojibwe shaman. If you want to follow this path, we're clean. We don't drink. On the Ojibwe path, if you're following it properly, we don't drink. We're cultivating vision. We want vision. We don't drink. You smoke tobacco responsibly. It's a sacred herb. You don't drink coffee because you don't need the stimulation and all the rest of it. Pretty strict. But I had had these troubling visionary experiences, part of what led me to believe that I was nuts. And I thought, well, I started going to the sweat lodge. And they said, well, you're a white boy, but you seem to be getting it. So they treated me, they welcomed me. And it was through the sweat lodge that I met an addictions counselor that put me in touch with the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist said, I'm not so sure that you need a pill. I'm like, come on, I need a pill. I want that pill that's going to make it all better, right? He said, no, I think you might have a problem with drinking and drugging. And why don't you, have you considered AA or NA? And he presented it in such a way I realized, okay, here's a hoop I've got to jump through. If I want that drug, which I wanted with the same intensity I wanted the drink and other drugs I was trying, okay, I'll go to a meeting. So I went to an AA meeting. This was in Winnipeg. And what I experienced there was, they greeted me, and one guy came up and gave me a big bear hug and scared the hell out of me. And I sat down around this table, and people opened up and talked about their feelings. I thought, what a bunch of pansies. Who are these people? And I thought it was a joke. I thought they were a joke. I thought the whole thing was a joke. I thought, cult? This is a cult? This is all secret? There's got to be more to it than this. It was all connected with this visionary thing. I thought, I see into this. There's something behind the facade here. There's more. I don't know if I like this. And so I left about three-quarters of the way through the meeting. Just left. Not for me. Not for me. I repulsed, sort of like you hold up a wafer or some garlic before a vampire. That was the, get me out of here, and the way I went. And I went back to the psychiatrist, and eventually I went on some drug that didn't do anything, or so I thought. So those are the two occasions that AA entered my life before coming to AA. So my drinking led to homelessness, to my questioning my sanity, horrible experiences of seeing things, and I didn't know what to do with that. I thought, I'm a white boy getting visions of what's going on. I ended up in my parents' home in the late my late 20s. I was 26, and pardon me, 26, and it was the 90s. And during my heaviest drinking and drugging years in Winnipeg, Manitoba, because I was only able to stay dry for a certain period of time following the Red Road, eventually I'd succumb to my disease. Excuse me. What happened was my drinking buddy. Now, I don't know if everyone here has experienced the phenomenon known as the drinking buddy, but my experience of the drinking buddy and drugging buddy was it's basically a kind of marriage. I was like bound to him. And we were watching each other's back as we were together committing a long, prolonged, torturous suicide. We were buddies, doing it together. We drink and get shit-faced. We watch each other. We help if I had beer and he didn't, and I go, here's some beer, and we watch each other. You know, oh, we need to eat. Let's go steal some KD. Okay, I got on it. And we come up with these plans, and we were like, and slowly kind of. And this was a guy. I don't know if you've heard the expression gonzo, as in gonzo journalism, as in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Hunter S. Thompson. Gonzo journalism, the expression gonzo comes from binge drinking and drugging, and it means that the first person, the last person standing at the end of a binge is the gonzo. This guy, my using buddy, was the gonzo. He was always the first at the party and the last to leave, committed to the career. So what happened was, I'm back in Ontario, he's still in Manitoba. I've long since left him behind. My using buddy had to leave him behind. I sit down and get a phone call out of the blue. And it's my buddy saying, hey, how are you? It's been a long time. By the way, I'm sober. I don't drink anymore. I don't drug anymore. I've come into the program. And the program means I have to make amends. And he said, when we were drinking buddies, I was often very abusive with you. And there were many times where he said, I think I've had enough. And he insisted that I do more. And he said he was sorry. And I can remember at the time I was extremely distracted. And there was I was suicidal and I was depressed. And I thought this guy is has changed his life as a result of this program. And a seed was planted. And I was on a bit of a high. It was like a shock. It was like a spiritual shock. And I hung up the phone, and for a couple of days after that, I thought, maybe this is for me. And then it went away again. And I went back into my depression, back into the suicidal feelings, back into the woe is me, the pity pot. But a seed was planted. I had contact with AA prior to that I thought was a joke, but here was a guy that it was a miracle. How did this? And I find myself forgetting sometimes to register the fact that we're people who a lot of others think we're not supposed to drink. We're not supposed to stop drinking. We're the people who are going to drink ourselves to a grave. And that's one of the things that's really exciting about reading a book like Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, because they talk about the urgency of the day when there were people, so many people desperately looking for a solution for this plague of alcoholism that was tearing families and communities apart. And up pops up the solution, and it starts to take. Suddenly people they couldn't keep up with the demand for a while there. There was a few-year period from like 38, 39 to 41, 42, where they couldn't keep up with the demand. People were taking to this and getting sober. So here was this buddy of mine where I was under the impression he was just never going to sober up. But he did. And that had me think, well, maybe there's some hope. Not only that, but I always felt a lot of sadness for the fact that I really liked him, and he was like my buddy, and I didn't like leaving him behind. I felt like I left a lot of people behind in my using and drinking days. We're all going down together, and a lot of that sadness, that kind of melodramatic sadness, led me to, you know, committing even further to the suicidal path. None of us are being saved. But then once it was presented in front of my face and I had evidence, look, people are starting to, they're getting their lives back, I couldn't say there's no answer anymore. I couldn't deny it. It touched me. That's what worked. So what ended up happening is I got a job. This is December of 1997 in this town in eastern Ontario. And I find myself being insinuated with the people who run this organization in a small town in eastern Ontario. And one of the people I'm brought into contact with is a member. And next thing I know, I'm being brought to meetings. I realized that I needed the meetings. So they start running me off to, they start taking me to meetings in different towns, and because there's only so many meetings in a town, I start getting into the fellowship, and I start realizing I'm an alcoholic. I start hearing shares, and I start hearing people talking about their stories. One of the things I love about the 12 and 12, they talk about the importance of raising a bottom. I was only 27 at the time. I had experienced a certain amount of hell, but I could have experienced a lot more. And I didn't realize that. I was still kind of cavalier about my own sobriety, but I heard a lot of people whose drinking careers went a lot farther than mine and whose lives got a lot worse than mine. And hearing that over and over again by going to meetings and talking with people had me start to go, wait a minute, I don't want to go that far. Let's take to this and help keep things fresh. Maybe fresh enough, I don't know. Now, I'm about to tell you a story of something that happened in my early recovery that some people have found controversial before. Consider this a bit of a warning. It's something I experienced in the fellowship, and I'm glad this is being recorded, because people didn't seem to want me to speak up about it, but I experienced it. Here it is. So I'm in the fellowship in Perth, Ontario, member of a meeting. I'm 3 months into my sobriety, and they're giving me the suggestions. Get a sponsor, start looking at the steps, get a home group. I had a hard time connecting with sponsors. For some reason, I always felt like when I approached a sponsor, like I was being cattle prodded or something. Like a shock, and I just, ugh, what's going on? I couldn't understand. I felt like I was being fenced in or something. I'm following the suggestions. What's going on? So eventually, a part of the fellowship comes up to me and says, you know, we've gotten to know you a little bit. How about that guy? You seem to have a lot, this guy seemed to have a lot in common. Maybe if you, you know, connect with him. So I did. I went up to him and said, hey, you know, would you consider being my sponsor? He said, sure. He lived out in the country outside of this town. He said, well, why don't you come up to my place with my girlfriend? I'm working on a car all day. We can hang out and get to know each other and talk. And I thought, what a great idea. Thank you. So my folks, because I was back under the, you know, protection of my folks at the time, brought out, dropped off, and left there. Looking back on it now, I think my instinct was starting to say something's up, but I either was too afraid or not able to listen to it. I didn't know any better. Here's what happened. Remember, the fellowship directed me to this person. I'm brought in for dinner, and the girlfriend, who's also a member, was making dinner, and they had an herb garden. And I'm using the can. I go downstairs, and I see a room filled with hydroponics. Okay, some people's recovery involves drugs. Great. But there was an awful lot of it. I thought, okay, well, some people's recovery involves selling drugs. Great. Okay, live and let live. I sit down for dinner, start eating dinner, and she's made some herbal tea. I drink the herbal tea. Next thing I know, I'm down on the ground in a convulsion, which I don't experience usually, on the floor, like this, twitching, and I can't even breathe. My heart's going about 180, 200 beats a minute. And they're standing over me, laughing, looking down at me, laughing, and I'm fucking terrified. I've just put my life and trust into the hands of this person that the Fellowship of AA in this pocket of the program, I will admit, said, he's the guy who's going to help you out. And this is being done to me? And then when I'm in that state, prone, vulnerable, on the ground, he says to me, you're going to come with me to Florida, because he's American, you're going to come with me to Florida and help me deal in Florida, and you're going to work for me. I feel like I have, I'm at the last place I feel I can go for help. The plan that's supposed to work. And I find myself in a convulsion on the floor, being told that I'm going to help them deal drugs. I had to crawl my way into another bedroom, crawl my way to the phone. I couldn't even speak and try to call my parents' number and say, can you come pick me up? What the fuck now? What the fuck's the matter with you? Jesus Christ, can't you do anything? What the fuck? Because I'm a failure? So I go home. My folks pick me up. They're kind of backed off. And I still don't know what their plan is, what they're going to do. I mean, this is like out of Deliverance or something. It's a cult. God knows. I'm brought to my parents' place, to the room where I was sleeping, and I lie in bed for about 3 or 4 days recovering from whatever the hell it was that was put in my system. I didn't feel like I could go to a hospital. I go back to a meeting. Glad this is being recorded. I go back to a meeting, which is my home group. It was a noon meeting. And I sit down at the table, and there are 12 people around the table. 12 people around the table, roughly, I think. And they make a point of sitting at one end. And I'm here at this end. And one of them comes up and says, well, now you have a sense of the way things work. So I will admit that I feel like I'm finally able to start to smile at this a little bit now, but at the time, I saw no way out. So I had been homeless. I thought, this is the solution. I've been presented with a solution. This is what happens. What else is there for me? Fuck it. So I ended up on the streets again. I went crazy and I felt distraught, couldn't communicate what it, who do I talk to? Who do I communicate it to? Who do I tell this? So I said, fuck it. And then I ended up back in Winnipeg, which is the city where I had been doing the drinking and drugging before, and resurfaced in meetings and started to get the feeling that there was something up. Now, am I speaking ill of AA? I don't believe so. I think that this is similar to finding, say, yourself being molested by a priest when you're taught to respect the church. The church is a healthy organization, I think, in and of itself. This is my opinion. Same with AA. At its core, it works. But pockets within the fellowship, pockets within, can sometimes stray. I don't believe what I experienced was AA, but it was under the guise of AA, and there are no rules. So people can come in and do all kinds of things under the name of AA. There are no rules. The lesson I learned, I would say, even if you're in early recovery, as best as you're able, if you can, keep your guards up. Trust your instinct. Pray. Ask the God of your understanding to guide you and trust it as much as you can. So what helped me to feel comfortable coming back to the program was when these priests, I wasn't Catholic, but I became one, gave me this feeling, which was not like that convulsion cattle prod feeling that I felt when I was in a heap on the floor, but I had this feeling of peace. People wonder, why did you convert? Well, that's why I converted. Because I think that's where I got the feeling that I've been looking for. So I went there. And that started to feel, please, I'm almost done. Thanks. Okay. So I start to get this feeling that I wasn't experiencing anywhere else. And he said, you should go back to AA. And he introduced me to a priest who was in recovery. And he brought me to meetings. And that's when I started to feel safe. So I come to Montreal, and I felt fearful. And I'm realizing now that part of what that, the experience that I had, I believe, was, is when I'm filled with fear, they talk about fear being the corrosive thread. Fear, in my experience in recovery, has been something that can be so powerful that can change the world around me. It almost it changes my perceptions, and it almost changes the way things happen around me. But when I find the path that is love and the God of my understanding, and the steps help lead that to happen, I find that things tend to happen quite a bit more smoothly. So this has entered a kind of urgency in my recovery, and I'm very, very grateful for it, because I don't want to become complacent in my recovery. I like the fact that there's almost a feeling of, you know, I'll tell you one other thing that I've shared a few times in recovery, and I'm glad I have a chance to share it tonight. Before I met the person who led me into the meetings, when I was, when I was given the job, and after the time that guy, the friend of mine, said, I'm in recovery, and I couldn't believe it. I wanted to kill myself. I'd been suicidal many times before, but I was getting awfully close. I just didn't want to live. Had no hope. So I wanted to fade away. I wasn't talking to people. I couldn't understand what was happening. I was losing the will to live. And I call it an intuition. I call it a spiritual experience. But what happened was, what came through to me from, I believe, my higher power, and thank God for it, was the realization, and it came to me like this, there are fates worse than death. I've heard people share in their shares, quite a lot actually, more than it surprises me to think back on it, in their shares would say, my sponsor told me that if I kept drinking and drugging the way that I was going to die. Or I realized if I kept living the way I was going to live, I was going to die. Even in AA, even in recovery, I'm going to die. Don't shoot the messenger. But it's a sure thing. However, the realization that came to me at that time was, there are fates worse than death. Reconsider your path. Even though I felt sad and in pain and wanted to die, maybe there was a price that if I would have done that radically selfish act. I've since looked up, and it turns out, for what it's worth, the church doesn't condemn suicide like they used to. They say there's a lot of compassion, and it's between that person and the God of their understanding, basically, to sort out, because there's an awful lot of things that can lead a person to that point. And it might not be their fault. It could be abuse, incest, rape, all kinds of things. Enough of that happens over time. It's very, very tough to hold on sometimes. So I found myself looking death in the face, basically, and saying, I felt like I was gifted with a sight that kind of brought me up to the edge, and I was able to look beyond, and I realized this wouldn't end necessarily with death. So when the opportunity came for me to come into a meeting, I jumped at it like a life preserver was being thrown at me. Like, this is something that's going to help me make that transition when that transition comes between this life and whatever's on the other side. I happen to believe there is something on the other side. And as a matter of fact, and God, this might be controversial, but I'm quoting literature, AA literature. In the 11th step, Bill Wilson writes, we do the program and live a spiritual life so that we can be reasonably happy in this life and we can be supremely happy in the next. Now, there are lots of gods of various understandings that may not include a life in the next. I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend. It's certainly a part of my recovery, and it seemed to have been a part of Bill's. Sometimes I feel like I'm chasing after a heaven that's an unreasonable expectation for me to have in this life. And when I realize that, I realize if I hold on for the reasonable happiness that I'm getting now, those great expectations can come. And that brings me to the kind of the stage of my life in my recovery these days. How much time do I have? The kind of stage of recovery that I'm in these days. I find myself wanting to follow God's will as much as I can. Because the God of my understanding, thanks to the program of AA and thanks to deepening my relationship with God through my faith, the church, I find myself wanting to do God's will and do whatever it takes. If that means deepening my relationship with the program and the fellowship, I'll do it. If that means becoming more involved with the community, I'll do it. And I realized that as I was sent to Montreal by a priest, my time here is through. There's nothing wrong with Montreal. Montreal's a great place. It's not for me to decide for anybody whether they're supposed to be here or not. But it's become very clear to me that in terms of my recovery, my time is done here. It's time for me to move on. And thank God for it, but the way that my higher power, through staying sober and working it as much as I can, communicates is if you insist on staying, it will become spiritually unsafe for you. So I want to go where I'm spiritually safe. So I listen to my higher power. Now, to have made a change and moved to Calgary a few years ago, I would have lacked the power to do it. But I feel like I'm in a place now where now that I have an understanding of God's will for me, for this, I've been praying for the power to carry it out. And on the other side, I'm starting to glimpse some of what's waiting for me there. And how do I glimpse it? I get a sense, I kind of see it, and I feel it. It's the feeling that makes the difference. I'm beginning to be able to tell when I'm feeling peace, and when I'm feeling that love and reassurance that's letting me know I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and that fear and terror that lets me know that I'm off the path. And for those of you, say, who happen to be Buddhist, this is depicted in the Buddhist path. If you're following it, bliss is yours, and there are images of the Buddha who's blue and blissed out. But if you fall off the path, there's the Buddha with the fangs and the claws, and he'll let you know when you're off the path. Take them as warnings. Be grateful for them. And a life in recovery has brought this kind of edge. I need to be alert, and I'm glad for it, because something could come almost at any time that could lead me to taking a drink, or I could start to go down that path where I start to find myself losing the will to live. I start to become extremely selfish and think only of myself, and next thing I know, I'm taking a drink and on a binge. And God knows where that could lead. And it isn't just, woohoo, I'm going to end my life drinking. For me, it also means, what's on the other side of that kind of path? So basically, I'm transferring my life to another city, and I'm already in touch with the fellowship there. It was another one. I've had a series of these wonderful coincidences, God incidents, as I've heard them called. I went to a meeting that was my old home group in NDG. I show up and see the boys and the gals. Hey, how's it going? Good to see you. Good to see you. What's up? I am moving to Calgary. Really? We just had somebody come 15 minutes ago. She came too early. He's from Calgary, visiting town. She'll be right back. She came back. I happened to share that night. We got to know each other. She said, here's a list of meetings I recommend. Here's my full name. Here's how to contact me. I'll put you in touch with people there. She was in her 20s, in my early 30s, well, late 30s. But she's putting me in touch with, you know, the fellowship. That kind of thing has just been landing in my lap. And that's the kind of thing that I had in my earliest recovery, first 3 months, for example. Those are the kinds of things that help me realize that I'm on the right path, that I'm doing the right thing. So there's a foundation. There's a life waiting for me there. And I guess the lesson as far as that goes that I'd say that what I feel I've learned, if I could offer anything, would be if you find yourself kind of grinding away and you're doing all the suggestions, you're following the program as best you can, but maybe you've had those spiritual experiences and awakenings and you find yourself kind of not having that anymore and wondering what's wrong, maybe you got to think outside the box a little bit. Maybe there's a little change, you know? Ask. It's not for me to say, well, you got to change your career, or you got to change the city you're living in, or whatever. But I would say, ask. Maybe God's been telling you, the God of understanding has been telling you, but like me, I wasn't listening because I was convinced it was Montreal. And I started to realize, oh, wait, my time here, I'm tacking, the boat's heading this way. So I'll end with this. If you work it, and I certainly hope and have faith that you work it, I've had times when I didn't in recovery, and those are very dry, frightening times. But when I work it, life becomes an adventure. It's exciting. And there's an edge, a kind of edge that I find that I need in my life to feel satisfied in recovery. Within my faith, they sometimes refer to it as radical discipleship. If you're really following it, you'll feel it. You certainly won't be bored. So I'm extremely grateful for having had the chance to speak. I did touch on some subjects that some might consider controversial. That wasn't my intention. I tried to speak as much as I could from my experience. I hope that some of it's been beneficial. And keep coming back. Thanks.